This year's presidential campaign has focused a great deal of attention on the white working class in America. These are people who often feel they've been left behind as the world changes economically, demographically, politically. The attention to that portion of society also helped focus attention on this hour's guest and his book. J.D. Vance writes of Appalachia and the Rust Belt in Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. J.D. Vance split his formative years between Jackson, Kentucky, that's the Appalachian town, and Middletown, Ohio in the Rust Belt. After high school, he enlisted in the Marines and served in Iraq. Post-Marines, he graduated from Yale Law School. Now he's the principal at a Silicon Valley investment company and a contributor to the National Review, among other places. J.D. Vance, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So how notable was getting to and through Yale Law, given your family and regional background?
It was very rare. There were very few people like me, and that's actually one of the reasons I decided to write the book, is because I looked around and realized how unique my experiences were and started to ask some pretty tough questions about why that was the case.
Let's start with the regional issues in Ohio. There's still a working steel mill, I see, in Middletown, but the general picture seems like one of fairly typical Rust Belt recession and decline.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There is still a steel mill in Middletown, Ohio. It's shed a fair number of jobs since its heyday, so there's not nearly as many people work there. And there's been labor strife in the past 5-10 years that never existed, frankly, because times were pretty good for much of the steel mill's operations. But in that way, Middletown's definitely one of the lucky towns. It's not one of these towns that's had its main employer just completely shut down. So while times haven't been super easy, I do think Middletown's made it better than at least a few.
All right, so that's the regional. Let's go to the ethnic part now. You say Scots-Irish, one of the most distinctive groups in the United States. I'm sure a lot of people say that about their own group, but you make a pretty good case here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, the Scots-Irish, a lot of times don't even know that they're Scots-Irish. It's one of these interesting demographic things that when you ask people how they identify ethnically, the people who are most likely to say American as opposed to, you know, Italian-American or Irish-American or whatever, but the people who say American are often Scots-Irish, and that's because in a lot of ways they've kind of subsumed their bigger identity, or excuse me, their ethnic identity into the bigger country, but they are very distinctive. If you look at these areas where the Scots-Irish predominate, there are very unique problems, but also I think really, really unique, interesting, and hilarious things that go on too, which of course I write about a fair amount of the book.
Well, there is a passing reference to the Hatfields and the McCoys in here, but it turns out those were far from the only two families that engaged in large feuds and some fairly destructive behavior.
That's absolutely right. The feuding culture of that part of the world is something that's been pretty well documented, but even I didn't realize how big of a part of it was even in my own family. I actually learned as part of writing the book that Jim Vance, who started the Hatfield-McCoy dispute, he was related to a Hatfield brother. He was actually a direct descendant of mine, though pretty distant back in time. And there are a couple of other famous feuding families, some of it which had been reported on the New York Times. There was a relative named Abner Vance who famously murdered someone over some sort of insult to his daughter. So there was a lot there, and it's kind of amazing that I didn't know even some of my own family history and how involved it was in these blood feuds.
You really had a foot in each place because you spent so much time in Kentucky in addition to where you went to school in Ohio. So were you aware from living in Ohio about some of the behavior that took place back in hillbilly country, as you put it?
Well, in a lot of ways, Ohio was as much hillbilly country to me as eastern Kentucky was. So like you said, I split my time between both places. But Middletown, Ohio was very heavily filled with Appalachian transplants. There was actually a jobs program at AK Steel that encouraged families to locate wholesale, you know, not just one or two, but they'd often bring, you know, a dozen cousins and brothers up to the steel mill in Middletown. And so we actually even called it as kids Middletucky because it just seemed like everyone around was as close to Kentucky as we were.
Among other things in the book, you cite, and I'm going to quote you here, a peculiar crisis of masculinity in which some of the very traits that our culture inculcates make it difficult to succeed in a changing world. Like what?
Well, what I think of as most important here is if you think about a young kid, a poor kid, honor and dignity and loyalty are really the only things you have. And so you'll fight to defend them. So when I was a kid, if someone insulted my mom or made a remark about my family, it was expected not just by my my peer group, but even by my family, that I would return the insult, and that I would fight if I needed to. And it's a relatively common thing for poor kids to be willing to go to great lengths to defend their honor, because frankly that's all they have. They don't have a whole lot else to hang their hat on. The problem is that when you grow up in an environment like that, you learn conflict as a way to as a way to solve disputes and a way to resolve problems. And that's not necessarily the way you want to live your life if you're in a corporate boardroom, or if, for example, you're in a 21st century marriage. It's something that you have to, in some ways, unlearn that hardwiring for conflict.
Ultimately, does life not feel right if you don't have something to fight against?
Well, I think that in some ways it doesn't feel quite right, and it's interesting how different folks in that area find something to fight against. You know, whether it's just being really passionate about a sports team, or being really, really critical of political elites, which I think is one way this has come up in the modern election. But there's definitely an element to where I think for a lot of the folks who I grew up around, for a lot of the people in my family, conflict is just a really important part of who we are, and we in some ways relish having a noble enemy.
Well, and you really get into some detail here about, not saying bad things about other people's mothers, and certainly not their grandmothers, but we'll get into some of the specifics of how life plays out in the hills and hollers of Kentucky, and then in Middletown, Ohio as well, through the eyes of J.D. Vance as he grew up there. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. We'll come back and talk more with J.D. and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Maybe you've had some similar experiences you'd like to share. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is J.D. Vance. He's written a book about his life growing up in both Appalachia, in Jackson, Kentucky, and in the Rust Belt in Middletown, Ohio. Split his time between those places as he was growing up because he had family in both places, most of his schooling in Ohio. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I mean, you certainly show us warts and much more of the cultures in which you grew up. I'm saying plural, but it's really a singular thing. But you also say, I love these people. I mean, while you're being honest about their warts, what prompted the book, J.D.?
Well, like I said, I was in law school and really concerned by the fact that I didn't see a whole lot of people like me at the law school. And of course, this is a time, and we're now still in that time, where people were very worried about upward mobility and the decline of the American dream. And so I decided to just start asking some really tough questions, both of my country, but also of my community, about why it was that there weren't more kids like me who were having an opportunity at that upwardly mobile American dream. And the answer that I came to is honestly that it was a combination of complex economic factors, but also some parts of our communities and families and neighborhoods that implicated certain parts of our whole culture. And so I decided that to be honest about those problems, I would be honest about the problems as I experienced them, but also as I had them myself. So I didn't want to write a book that was critical of other people. I wanted to write a book that was compassionate and, yes, somewhat critical about my own people, and that, of course, includes myself.
And so often it seems like it's not necessarily that people are being defeated by people other than themselves, but often by themselves.
That is sometimes true, and I think it's treacherous the way that we talk about these problems, because on the one hand, I think it's very easy to get caught up in victim blaming and to look at the poor and say, you know what, you're poor because of your own moral failings or because you've done something significantly wrong. But I do think, on the other hand, we have to be upfront and we have to be frank about what it is that poor folks don't know, what it is about their neighborhoods and communities that make it really hard for them to get ahead. And the answer is ultimately that there are a lot of things that they don't know, that they're There are a lot of values and a lot of attitudes that their neighborhoods and communities imbue them with that make it hard for them to succeed in the 21st century. And like I said, I think the only way to really address those problems is to be very upfront about them.
Let's get an idea of your attachments to people and place. You say that Kentucky belonged to you in ways that Ohio didn't. How did that work out?
I'm sorry, I missed that question.
Well, you said that Kentucky belonged to you that in ways that Ohio didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I meant by that is that I had a pretty chaotic upbringing in Southern Ohio. My mom struggled with addiction, and in many ways she struggled, I think, with the demons of her own violent, chaotic childhood and projected those problems onto her own children. And so, the life I had in Southern Ohio was going to and from different stepdads and boyfriends, living in a different home every 3 or 6 or 9 months, occasionally seeing mom abuse drugs. But in Kentucky, where I only went with my grandma, who I lived with some of the time but not all of the time in Southern Ohio, in Kentucky it was just me and my grandma and my sister. As my grandma said, there would be no men, there would be no outsiders, no strangers in my great-grandma's home. And so it just felt like it was my family and only my people, and frankly the people that I wanted to be around the most and spend the most time with. So it was just this incredibly stable, loving place, even though at the end of the day it was also very poor.
A stable, loving place, but certainly with a history of some fairly rambunctious behavior. It sounds like you kind of reveled in the stories of bloody encounters between family members and others.
I definitely did revel in it, and that was a lot of ways the lessons that I was taught by these stories. It's not just that we were doing crazy or violent things, I'm talking about my family here, but it's also that we were doing crazy things in the service of something, in the service of a family's honor, in the service of a sister's honor, in the service of defending our mother. And so there was this element of vigilante justice that I felt like my uncles and my cousins, they were all enforcers of this justice. And I really loved them for it. In a lot of ways, I tried to emulate them in my own life, not always to the best effect.
J.D. Vance is our guest on The Exchange. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy. And so you got some warnings from elders, your grandparents on both sides, about never to be the first one to throw a punch. Was there an exception to that rule, though?
Well, you were never supposed to be the first one to throw a punch, but it was very easy to get someone else to throw a punch because we took our honor and we took our duty to our family very seriously. So if you didn't want to start a fight, you could always just insult someone's mom or grandma and they would start a fight for you.
In your telling on the Kentucky side, certainly, it sounds like people generally did not get serious jail time or sometimes even go to jail at all for things that were seen as, well, justified, to use the name of the TV series about that same part of the world.
Yeah, that's definitely true, though I don't know that would be true today. You know, a lot of these stories of family violence and family lore, they occurred in the 70s or the 60s or even before. And in a lot of ways, it was obviously a little bit more of a wild time. I doubt that folks could get away with what my uncles and my grandfather got away with back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I imagine there would be some jail time or some consequences that would come along with it these days. And frankly, if you look at the rising incarceration rates among this group of people, it's probably, it's probably the case that there's a lot that maybe folks would have gotten away from 50, 60 years ago that they're not getting away with now.
What has happened to Jackson, Kentucky, since your childhood?
Well, Jackson was in some ways a really harsh place as far back as I could remember. So it was never a place of incredible opportunity. It was always a very impoverished place. I think in a lot of ways it's definitely gotten worse. Not so much in terms of poverty, because like I said, it's always been a very poor place, but in some of the social indicators that often come along with poverty. So I think folks are probably working even less than they used to, a little bit more reliant on disability and other forms of government assistance. But also the big issue is that there's been this rising opioid epidemic that's moved into places like Jackson and frankly into Southern Ohio that's caused rising mortality rates, but also just this incredible hopelessness, because it's the sort of place where you open up the newspaper and you just look for the 20, 25-year-old kids who have died, but the obituary doesn't list their cause of death because their parents are too ashamed, And we all know folks like that. We all know kids who fall into that trap. And so it's just a very sad place in a lot of ways.
That's the local news, and then occasionally the place makes national news, and not for good reasons. You mentioned that ABC News came into that part of Kentucky and about 7 years ago. What was the story about?
Well, it was about Appalachian, depending on where you're from, Appalachian poverty. And the big takeaway from that series is that there are a lot of people who are really struggling, a lot of folks who, if they didn't have government assistance, could even starve to death. And a lot of kids who grow up in these very chaotic environments where it's difficult to study and difficult to really think about and plan for your future. And what was really interesting about this, you know, it was done by Diane Sawyer, who's actually from Eastern Kentucky, but it actually caused a lot of anger from people who grew up in that region of the world. You know, there were a lot of folks who said, look, this is a pretty honest look at the problems that exist in these communities. But there was, frankly, a big backlash against that documentary because people felt it unfairly maligned people as dumb, toothless hillbillies. And that conflict, that contrast between recognizing that there are very legitimate problems, but also seeing some of these criticisms as stereotyping, that has always existed in that region of the country, and it's something I try to avoid in the book. Maybe I did a good job, or maybe I didn't. I think time will tell.
J.D., you've lived in several places now, and how would you say is the perception of the American dream in Appalachia, at least of the part that you knew? I mean, does it exist there at all?
A lot of people don't think that it does exist, and if you look at the statistics, they're not totally out of line in thinking that the future may not be better than the past. You know, a lot of these areas, it's not just that it's difficult to come by good jobs, it's also difficult to raise a successful family. It's difficult to raise a kid without that kid getting caught up in drugs or crime or something else. And the people there, both if you talk to them, but also if you look at some of the data, are very pessimistic about their economic future. They are quite convinced that their kids are not going to live a better life than they did. And unfortunately, it's not always true, but it is increasingly true that it's hard for folks who grew up in these areas to get ahead. There was a massive study done by a Harvard economist about 4 or 5 years ago that looked at the different regional allocation of the American dream, and he found, you know, places like Utah and places like Oregon and California, the American dream's doing pretty well, it's alive and well, but in a lot of these Rust Belt and southern areas, folks find it really, really hard for their children to have a better life than they did.
J.D. Vance, in a sense, straddles the Ohio River with a foot in Kentucky and a foot in Middletown, Ohio, a steel town, so the Rust Belt and hillbilly country, as he puts it. His book is called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts on the topics we're bringing up here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So why did you grow up in Middletown or Middletown, as you sometimes called it? Who took your family out of Kentucky and in search of what?
So my grandparents initially moved to Middletown because it was the land of opportunity. When they grew up in eastern Kentucky coal country, there were really two choices. One was to go down in the mines, as they said, so work in a coal mine, or the other was to not really be able to find work at all. And so my grandpa didn't want to do either of those things, and my grandma was young and pregnant. So they decided to move to southern Ohio, like a lot of other families and people, and try to find work in the industrial economy in southern Ohio. And they, of course, did. My grandpa earned a good wage for his entire life, had a good career, really loved what he did. And that really took our family, our entire family story, you know, from eastern Kentucky to southern Ohio. But, of course, it never quite left. We were always very attached to eastern Kentucky. At least I was, because I grew up with my grandparents and so spent a lot of time in their home because they still spent a lot of time there themselves.
And as you mentioned already, a fair amount of that part of Kentucky seemed to come with up the so-called Hillbilly Highway and take residence in the same area. So you had essentially a Kentucky enclave, hence the term Middletucky for Middletown. Give us a sense, though, of what people back in Kentucky thought of the people who moved away.
Well, there was definitely some stigma attached to the folks who left. We had this phrase that was often used against anyone who our family perceived had become non-humble or a little overconfident. We said, you've gotten too big for your britches. And my grandparents heard that a lot from their family back in Kentucky, that they had gotten too big for their britches, that they maybe were a little bit too disconnected from the holler and from the Eastern Kentucky homeland that all of us cared about so deeply. And I think it's really sad because in a lot of ways my grandma never felt at home in Southern Ohio. For the folks that were from Middletown, or excuse me, from Kentucky, you know, she always liked those people and felt at home among them. But for the native Ohio citizens who were maybe a little more upper income, she always felt a little maligned and a little looked down upon by those folks. And so it was this weird juxtaposition where the people that she considered her family thought that she had grown too big for her britches, but the new home that she had settled into, they didn't totally accept her either.
Huh. So you like the poor relations in the new place and like the people who think they're too good for us in the old place.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So certainly in tamer country as they moved to Middletown, but not tamed. Tell the story of Uncle Jimmy with Mama and Pawpaw in the pharmacy looking at toys.
Yeah, so my Uncle Jimmy was 9 or 10, and he talked about there was a toy that he really wanted, and a pharmacy had that toy. So he went in and started playing with it, and the store clerk told him, basically, put that down, stop messing with it, you're going to break it. So my Uncle Jimmy stood outside in the cold and felt a little chastised, I'm sure, as any kid would. And my grandparents happened upon him and said, you know, what happened? And he told the story, and they were just very unhappy that this store clerk dared to speak down to their little kids. So they went in there, and they really ransacked the place. They started throwing everything. My grandpa actually took one of the toys that my uncle had been playing with and slammed it on the ground and broke it. And then, you know, he moved towards the store clerk in a very menacing way and actually threatened to break his neck if that clerk ever talked to his son like that again. And I think this just goes to show that they were always a little out of place in their new homes. They didn't quite know how to fit in and, you know, in with the Christmas shopping throng, but they also, you know, they still lived there and they had to figure it out.
So outsiders could certainly not disrespect the family, but how about people within the family?
Well, you know, insiders could disrespect and could be very frank, and I think that's one of the big bright lines that exists between those who criticize Appalachia or the people who live there and those who are considered outsiders and are perceived as not allowed to criticize it. So, you know, my grandparents felt very strongly that if you were inside the Klan, you could be as open or as honest about the family's problems as you wanted to be. But if you were outside of the Klan, if you were even outside of the home, but maybe related by blood, then, you know, you weren't to be trusted and you weren't to be, you weren't to be entrusted with family secrets.
I want to let people know who are just joining us, it's Klan with a C, not Klan with a K. We're talking to J.D. Vance about his book, Hillbilly Elegy. Your mom was one of three surviving kids of Mama and Papa, born in 1961. What was the success rate in life in of the three?
So my aunt and my uncle both did reasonably well. They both built successful homes, successful families, and each had successful careers in their own way, though they certainly took roundabout ways getting there. But my mom was the one for whom the statistics really caught up to. You know, they grew as good as my grandparents were to me. They did provide a very violent and chaotic home to their own children, and my mom really suffered from that, I think, for her entire life, and continues to, in some ways, suffer through it today. It's one of the interesting parts of writing the book that I've actually learned that my mom is really a sympathetic figure. And even though she struggled, I think, to make good decisions in her own life, I think I understand why she struggled, knowing a little bit about her own background. But, you know, she was never quite able to hold down a great job, never able to build a successful marriage. She's been married 5 times. And you know, towards the past 10 or 15 years has really struggled with drug addiction that's so common in these areas. So in a lot of ways, you know, Mom, like I said, is the kid who lost the game of statistics.
Okay, so with her own challenges, there's been challenges for Middletown itself through the years, certainly. We talked earlier about the fact that the steel mill is still open, although not with as many people as it used to have. What's the general state of play in downtown Middletown? Is it a fairly typical hollowed-out Rust Belt community?
Yeah, very typical hollowed-out Rust Belt community. You know, Central Avenue and Main Street meet downtown, and there aren't a whole lot of businesses besides medical supply stores and cash for gold stores. I will say that Middletown has tried pretty hard to to do some urban revitalization. There have been a couple of nice stores that have moved in downtown, even in the past few years, you know, things I've noticed when I go home to visit family. So the people of Middletown are proud, and they are really trying. And I think that in some ways, the town may have bottomed out a few years ago. If I'm being hopeful and optimistic about the future, what I'm most hopeful about is that some of the revitalization we've seen in the past few years will stick, and that Middletown will find a way out of what has been a really rough few decades.
All right, and not atypical for that part of the country, as we've discovered with a couple of other guests on the exchange as well. J.D. Vance's book is called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis, essentially one foot in the Rust Belt in Ohio and one foot in hillbilly country in Kentucky. We'll come back and talk more with J.D., and you can join this discussion with us at 800-838-3760 by phone or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with J.D. Vance and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is J.D. Vance, who's written a memoir called Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and culture in crisis. He asks out loud in the book, why is a guy in his 30s writing a memoir? Well, it's because he comes from interesting worlds. He split his time growing up between Appalachia in Jackson, Kentucky, and the Rust Belt in Middletown, Ohio, which he often referred to as Middletucky, because so much of the hillbilly country seemed to come with his family when they moved there. Really interesting look at lower-class whites in America and the fate they have met over the years from a real micro perspective. And he uses some macro stuff as well to play the picture bigger. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the exchange with J.D. Vance.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
This is a topic that I really, really had hoped more people would be addressing over these last year or so when we've been talking about Black Lives Matter, is that there's this huge number of people in rural and small-town America who have the same sense of hopelessness and cycles of violence, and no one seems to be talking about the white lower middle class or working class. And they talk about stigma, of course, of race, but the stigma in a small-town or rural area of having a name, say you're a Smith from, you know, Boxter Creek or something, and you will never break out of being a Smith from Boxter Creek, and the police or sheriff will know who you are and follow you around, so you can be as targeted as a poor white person.
Oh, because you're one of that family, yeah.
Right, right, as targeted in a sense as if you were racially identifiable. And so that aspect of hopelessness and violence and circular violence can occur in a white community, especially the poor communities in rural and small-town America, and I'm very interested in reading his book because it will be addressing that huge, huge problem.
All right.
Thank you for having him as a guest.
Oh, sure. That was certainly Emily's doing. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate that. How much of that went on in Kentucky? I mean, if you were a member of the Vance clan, I don't know what the kind of reputation you had back there was, but there certainly had been some fights and use of electrical saws and things like that over the years, which I giggle about because the guy survived, but youch. I mean, so, where do people ever eye you in Jackson and say, oh, you're one of the Vances?
No, I always felt like people really, people, if anything, had a higher opinion of me if they knew who my grandparents were in Jackson. That's partially just because it was a very rural area, so there wasn't a whole lot of law enforcement, and the law enforcement that was there really knew most of the folks who grew up in those areas. And, you know, as much as my family had been dedicated to vigilante justice, they never made much of a problem for law enforcement, at least in the way that I understood it. And so I always felt like they felt pretty welcomed, by the police in Jackson. I will say that there were definitely some elements of that in southern Ohio where they felt that, you know, certain members of the Kentucky diaspora, certain folks who had come from Kentucky who they knew were definitely looked down upon by the police and were singled out sometimes for mistreatment. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a significant part, I'd say, of my family's personal experience. So that certainly isn't to say that, as the caller mentioned, it's something that folks, that we were certainly aware of, and I think is definitely true for a lot of people.
You know, one of the things, obviously, that made this book what it is the fact that you managed to get out of Middletown. You ended up at Yale Law and have made a career for yourself in investments in Silicon Valley now. As you were growing up, though, I mean, it was still Armco Steel back then. It's AK Steel now, still open but smaller. What was your wish or belief about your ever working there?
Oh, I had, you know, I had no idea that I'd be doing, you know, anything like I'm doing now. And, you know, I figured, like most kids, that I probably didn't want to work at Armco because, you know, my grandparents were very insistent that I should go to college and get some sort of job. I always figured that I'd be able to. You know, it's you know, I think no kid thinks that steel mill work is glorious, and that's not something they really aspire to when they're 11 or 12 years old. But the flip side is that I always assumed it would be there if I needed it. And, of course, for a lot of kids, it's not.
You say, you write to the average Middletonian, hard work doesn't matter as much as raw talent.
Yeah, there's definitely a perception that hard work matters a whole lot less than raw talent. When I got into Yale Law School, so many people congratulated me basically for being some sort of genius or being super smart. And as I write in the book, that's just not true. I think I got a little bit lucky, and I think I worked pretty hard. But the idea that folks who are at places like Yale or Harvard are just extraordinarily brilliant, no, they're pretty smart, they're pretty lucky, and they work hard. And that's I think true of most of the American elite. But I think that it goes to show how disconnected people are from places like Harvard and Yale, from Washington, D.C., because they don't see anybody from their town making it. They don't see that it's possible to go to a great college or to have a great career. And so they start to, I think, assume things about the people who do make it that in many cases just aren't true.
Well, and the people, the assumptions that are made from the folks who were essentially stuck back in places like Middletown. I mean, I want to be careful and not label a whole bunch of people lazy, but you do get in some pages here about your observations about the men in that culture.
Yeah, and I don't think it's primarily about laziness as much as I think it's about people not believing that their choices matter. So there's this concept called learned helplessness, which is effectively after you've been beaten down so much, after you've seen so few things work out in your favor, you stop believing that you actually have agency over your own life. You start to think, well, I can try, but it's not going to matter, so I'm not going to try. And there are a lot of people who grew up in these areas, a lot of kids who take this message to heart, who just don't see any connection between their hard work and their achievements and any sort of material success. And so, again, it breeds this sense of hopelessness and frustration that no matter how hard I work, no matter how hard I try, I'm not going to get ahead. I think it's important to note, and one of the things I try to be very explicit about in the book, is that I don't think that attitude is totally right. I do think that we have to recognize that poor folks in America face unique barriers, but we also have to give them a message that they can control their own destiny. And that was something that my grandma really, really fought against in me, was that perception that the deck was stacked against me. She knew life wasn't fair, but she also made sure that I believed that I had some control over my own life, because without that, I wouldn't have had the incentive to make better choices.
Well, you know, and a lot of things could have gone wrong for you. You pointed out how much trouble your mother had holding decent jobs and holding on to relationships. A lot of churn of father figures in your life growing up. How much of a rock then were those grandparents in Middletown?
Oh, they were the most important things in my life, absolutely. They were the things that gave me stability, that gave me comfort, that made sure I had access to meals and to school clothes when I really needed them. You know, we talk about the safety net in this country, and for a lot of folks, the only safety net, of course, they have is some sort of assistance from the state or from the federal government. But for me, the biggest safety net in my life was Mamaw and Papaw, because they really gave me all the things that I didn't have and made sure that I had a chance and made sure that I had a good life when other things in my world were falling through.
What were their views on education? How much did they help, for example, with schoolwork?
Yeah, they thought education was really important. They never let me forget that I was blessed to have an education. I think that's an attitude that it's really easy to forget when you grow up in a country as wealthy as ours. But for them, you know, they grew up in a one-room school shack. My grandma didn't graduate from high school. And so they really made sure that I believed that I was lucky to get an education. And even when I didn't quite believe it, they just, you know, they would be mean about it if they had to and made sure I did my schoolwork. My grandpa loved to practice math problems with me because he thought it was important that I learn, you know, math ahead of the rest of my class. And in a lot of different ways, they gave me this subtle signal that education mattered and that I needed to take things of the mind, pursuits of the mind, very seriously because they didn't have the opportunity to do so themselves.
And that really stuck. I mean, and certainly there was enough turmoil around you with, for example, when your mom and third husband moved you guys away from Middletown, and that got ugly. And then you mentioned that answering questions about brothers and sisters got complicated because of all the half and step siblings. Was there a turning point at which your formative years reached relative stability, JD?
There definitely was. You know, when I was, there were a couple turning points. So when I was 12 years old, my grandma basically set a family rule that I was allowed to live with her whenever I wanted to. And that always gave me a sort of backstop, a safety valve. So if things ever got too chaotic at my own home, I was always able to go and spend some time with her and make things you know, easy that way. And then the second turning point was when I was 14, or I think 15 actually, and my grandma took that choice to go and live with her to a demand that I live with her permanently and constantly. And that was actually that was actually set in motion because my mom had demanded a jar of clean urine because she needed to pass a urine test, and she didn't have clean urine herself. So she came to Mamaw's house when I was staying there one night and said the next morning, "Look, you've got to give me this jar of urine, or I'm going to fail this test." And I think then Mamaw realized that what was happening in the world around me was really starting to take its toll. I almost failed out of high school my freshman year when this happened. And she finally said, "Look, this has got to stop. You're going to come and stay with me, not every couple times per week, but you're going to come and stay with me permanently, and that's not going to change until you graduate from high school."
Wow. So you really laid the line down and said, "This is what's going to happen."
Yeah.
As things turned around and as you got better in high school and went to the Marines, went to Ohio State, went to Yale Law, it seems like your eye for detail, though, it must have developed before you left for the Marines. I'm thinking that started when you're still in Middletown.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I definitely have always had an observer's eye and have always considered the things around me and tried to keep track of them. So you definitely think, obviously, it served me well as I wrote the book, that there were a lot of little details that I remembered or a lot of little things that I saved, actually. You know, there were memories that had completely fallen away but were kind of jiggered because I actually remembered that I had a note or I had a card or I had an old photograph that a lot of people might have thrown away.
All right. So you clearly resist the idea that life is worse for working class whites purely because of economics. And there's a phrase that really stands out from early in the book. You write about a culture that increasingly encourages social decay instead of counteracting it. How does it encourage social decay?
Well, it encourages social decay by some of the things I talked about earlier, that it encourages kids to think that they don't have much of an opportunity, that they don't have much hope, that the future and the deck is stacked against them. It encourages decay by exposing them to environments that make it very hard for them to have successful families themselves, right? So it's not just that my mom was some sort of villain. It's that she actually learned family chaos and instability from her own parents, and then she applied that lesson to her own children. And, of course, if we weren't lucky, if we didn't have my grandparents kind of getting their act together, I think my sister and I would have then applied that lesson to our children. And it's just impossible to do well in school and to have much of a successful life when you fear the school bell at the end of the day, when you don't want to go home. So that's one way. That's another way it encourages that social decay. I think it encourages that social decay by pointing the finger sometimes at folks who have wronged us, without asking us to think about the ways that we could make our own lot better. And so, you know, you take these things together, and it's not always the case that it's easy for us to get ahead. And sometimes that's because of external factors, but sometimes it's because of the things that we're doing and saying to ourselves.
There's lots of praise for Hillbilly Elegy, especially because of the passions of working class whites in this election. I mean, what do you make of that phenomenon and people connecting your book to it?
Well, it's interesting. I of course, didn't write a political book. It's obviously true that a lot of the people that I write about are ultimately the base of the Donald Trump movement and are the sort of folks who are so frustrated with the elites and with the political and financial class that they're willing to support Donald Trump. So I think in some ways it's natural to draw the inference between my book and the political moment because of just how these blue-collar white voters have been such a big part of the election. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that these voters are still going to be around long after Donald Trump fades. They're still going to be frustrated in a lot of ways. They're still going to have, I think, significant social problems. And so I hope that this starts a conversation that doesn't just finish after Trump loses, which I think he will lose. I hope that it continues long into the next 4, 5, 10 years, because these voters and these people really do, I think, need help. And we ought to think constructively about how to help them.
How tricky is it to give that help, though, with the amount of pride that comes, particularly with this culture that you describe?
It is hard. It is definitely hard to break through that pride and convince people, one, that there are things that they can do to make things better, and also that there are things the government can do to help them out. But it's not impossible, and I think that we ought to give it a good shot.
All right, it's a fascinating book, Hillbilly Elegy, A Memoir of a Family and Culture in Crisis. J.D. Vance wrote it and joined us on The Exchange today. J.D., thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All right, take care.